Good morning, diners, travelers, imbibers. We've got a little special treat for you for on the menu this morning.
A little drinky poo today, huh?
We're going to start out with wine. We're going to move on to craft beer. Then we're going to have a little saucy mama marinade. And mustard.
And then you can crave cheese.
And then you can have some cheese with that.
That's a double entendre, as you'll find out. I'm not sure I can get through this program. I've been gardening so much. It's finally springtime in the Berg.
Yes.
And Peter's been out in the garden, bending over and scratching around in the dirt and trying to pull out all the weeds and all that kind of wonderful stuff. I feel terribly green-fingered today.
You know, you talked about the bird. The Berg and spring in the Berg. Do you know that we have a liver and onion club here?
I didn't know that. But
the Wall Street Journal had an article this morning about it.
Anyway, we're founder members of that society. That's for sure. The funny part about it is we buy our liver from Whole Foods Market whenever they have it, and we suspect that the section it's in is the pet food section, but we buy it and enjoy it anyway. But anyway, back to the program. Our first guest is a truly remarkable man.
Oh, is he knowledgeable?
A most unusual background for someone who has become one of the world's greatest authorities on wines. What can we say other than Rajat Par?
Rajat Par has what many people would consider an absolutely dream job, in that he spends half of his day tasting wine.
Three quarters
of his day tasting wine, and the balance of the day describing it and selling it to people in 18 restaurants, named after Michael Minna, who's been around the restaurant business for quite a long time. But the story today is the story of Rajat Par, sommelier in chief, and when we get done, we'll conclude by talking about the fact that he also happens to have a considerable interest in a restaurant and wine bar in San Francisco where he operates a good deal of the time. But you're dealing with a total of 18 restaurants. That's a lot.
Yeah, it is. Keeps me busy.
Well, how did you start out from Calcutta to becoming such a celebrated sommelier? And incidentally, listeners, if you think you know the wine business and Rajat Par's name is not familiar, then you don't know the wine business very well. He wouldn't say that, but I can say. So how did we begin this journey, and how did we end up where we ended up?
I grew up in Calcutta. I went to school there. Then I moved down to the south of India to go to hotel school. And then from there, I came to the U.S., to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park to train and try to be a chef, because that was my dream. And I spent some time in England with my uncle, and he was the first person to pour me some wine, and I was very intrigued and interested. And when I went to the culinary school, they had a wine program there, so I joined the wine club, started tasting and reading. And while I was still planning to be a chef, you know, I was always keeping a pulse on the wine scene and what's going on in the wine business. And this is in 94, 95. And then I graduated in 96, and by then I had a real interest for wine, and I decided I need to work with someone who knows wine.
So you were in New York, and then you said, decided, well, you really needed to find a job in the wine serving business.
Right.
So how many restaurants did you apply to? I think your book says about 60.
Yeah, 60 restaurants, and the offers I got were all line cook offers. I think no one read my cover letter. They just saw my resume.
Right.
Uh-huh. I was applying for a front of the house position job, and they all thought I was applying for a line cook job. So I got some offers, some line cook jobs in New York, and I did not pursue them, and I moved to look for Larry Stone at Rubicon. And I took a plane and I came straight from the airport to Larry to talk to him, but he wasn't there, so I spoke to somebody else, and they're like, the only job we have for you is a food runner's position.
So that's how you started out, huh?
Yes, I'm like, all right, I'll take that because I'm here and I'm not going back. So
the book isn't quite as basic as that in the story. You sort of gloss over that and say Larry didn't have much time for you.
I bet he wasn't even. You know, somebody else probably took the call and said, okay, you know, I'll interview him just another interview. So
gotcha. So that was the start. And how many years ago was that? That was in 1994.
That was in October of '96.
'96. Okay, so you've come a long way since then. In 15 years, how many wines do you think you've tasted?
I would probably say 20,000-30,000 wines.
And you remember them pretty well.
I try as I get older.
you said you take a lot of tasting notes, but
a lot of notes. Yeah, always. You have to. It's the only way you can remember, because pass it and your mind definitely forgets.
Right, but not really. So there's a story in the book about your being put on the spot to blind taste Burgundy wine, and you had a cold, so you weren't sure you wanted to venture into that, and you got all the way through, and you really knew who the producer was, as well as the designation and the area and all that kind of stuff.
It happened to me last night at Michael Mina. I walked in, and there was a guest there, and they're like, "What's this?" And I'm like,
"Okay, well, what was the answer?"
I said, "It's 78 Pauillac, maybe Lafitte, Oliver." It was a 78 Mouton.
Oh dear, you missed it by one. Never mind. Everybody has a bad day. Now,
trust me, as good as you get, I mean, definitely, you know, I was better 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I don't taste that many wines blind anymore, so you definitely lose. It's an art, but it's a very focused art. You have to keep doing it. You can't just like, it's difficult. It's not easy. And the more you do it, the better you get at it.
We talked to Aldo Somme from La Bernarda.
Oh, he's great.
And
he said
I just have this incredible memory. He said I just have this incredible taste memory. Very rarely lets me down. I guess he was voted the world's best sommelier, and apparently you can't even re-enter that competition. So
yeah, he is the best. You know, he's a good friend, and he's one of the most amazing sommeliers in the world. Maybe I have never met anyone better than him for service, blind tasting, and
he pairs things other than wine, other beverages with food. Do you do that too?
Yeah, absolutely. We have, you know, we do a beer pairing, a sake pairing.
Yeah, he puts sake with seafood for us.
Absolutely. Sometimes there are some dishes you have to have something, which is other than wine, because wine might not work with it. So.
We of course should have mentioned, because Peter started off the interview, we got off on slightly wrong foot. We should have mentioned that the reason we're talking to Rajat Pawar is because he just published a book called Secrets of the Sommeliers, which is a book Peter obviously needed to get. Peter not only got it, Peter read it from cover to cover, which is very unusual. You probably realize we get lots of books and we very rarely read them all, but this I really couldn't put this one down. And I thought there were two parts of it that to me were particularly meaningful. One was your section on blind tasting, where you talk about the importance of establishing a benchmark, a wine that for you recognizably says this wine is this grape and grown in these regions of the world, and I'm going to be able to cling to that when I taste a wine and try to categorize it, and it's new to me. And so that whole section is really beautifully put together, and you not only describe the characteristics of the wine, but you also give some examples.
Yeah.
What do you call them, iconic?
Iconic and classic and value. The reason I did that was, we did that, me and Jordan McKay, my co-author and dear friend, who without whom this book would never be complete, because put so much passion and love in the writing. And so the reason we did that was, when a young sommelier or a young wine professional, anybody who opens a book, they need to know what the classic examples are. They need to know where the benchmark wines are, because that's the only way you can actually understand wine. Because if you don't know what a Cabernet really tastes like, because nowadays Cabernet tastes like who knows what, or sometimes a classic Pinot Noir or a Cabernet Franc or Nebbiolo, because they all can be exaggerated and made in a modern style. If you don't know the classic examples, you'll never understand basic of wine. So we took that chapter, and then we took it from the sommelier's perspective of how we taste the wine blind and how we have marker pointers which take us to the wine, tasting wines blind. It's very important. It's the most important tool for any taster to know classic examples, so they know exactly what Syrah tastes like. And
now, you have one. Can you think of a particular example of, among the many that you have in the book?
Syrah is a good example. In a classic Syrah, you get that blueberry, the pepper, and if it's cold or tea, you get the bacon fat, the smoke, all these examples. And there are many Syrahs, if you have, of course, Shiraz from Australia, many of them won't have that. They will be more jammy and more exuberant and more fruity. So it's a different style. I think you must understand what Syrah they came from the Northern Rhone, and then the different styles from other places in the world.
Great. Well, that's kind of a natural segue to the other part of the book that I thought was particularly fascinating, because you're nothing if not men of firmly held opinions,
right,
and firmly held statements. So I went to the section of the book about the wine region, which is your favorite and seems to be the favorite of most everybody in the wine business, that wonderfully seductive area called Burgundy. And you talk about the whites and the reds of the different regions. And here's a classic opinion that I think is the kind of thing that's here that's fascinating and important for people to understand. First of all, the love heaped on Merceau, which is many people's favorite white wine from that region. There is no question that Pouliny Montrachet is the greatest wine-producing commune in the world.
That's what I think, and that's probably what, if you talk to, you know, 100 sommeliers around the...
They'll probably say the same thing.
Yeah. The same thing. You know, Le Morachet, it's such a special piece of land. The wines are incredible and age amazingly. And for tasting all the wines of the world, I think most of it has come back to the love for Burgundy, which is, it's a mysterious love. It's a love that you try to understand and you know, it mystifies you and you go towards it and runs away. It's something very hard to grasp, and nobody would say, oh, I know Burgundy well. I know everything about Burgundy, because it's a work in progress. It changes every day. It changes every year. Not only vintage, but also the character of the bottle. So it's pretty amazing. And my love for Burgundy started right in the beginning, before I even got into wine, seriously, when I went there for the first time. So I went straight to Burgundy from day one. From the day I started Rubicon, I had a fascination for Burgundy. And now I know the region well, the people. It's, when I go back there, it's like going home. I go there at least 3 times a year.
Now, the wonderful thing about it is, I think a lot of books about wine, a lot of articles about wine, I find Wine Spectator myself to be particularly guilty of this. All the wines are great, and there's all this gilded prose to describe them. So it's almost impossible to tell from reading the description whether this is a wine you're really going to like or not, because they all sound really good.
Right.
But you're not afraid to express a contrary opinion. So on page 183, where you write about the wonderfully descriptive commune of Von Romanée, which I think I'm pronouncing correctly, but my first piece of advice about Von Romanée is to avoid La Grand Rue, which just happens to be a Grand Cru, one of perhaps it's the only one in that region. But you then go on to explain why, that although you would think that a Grand Cru designation would say it's the best wine from this area, you don't think it is, and you're not afraid to say so.
Yeah, no, there are many things in the book which might be favorable to producers or to appellations. It's just what I think is, and just what we think, and I don't want to sugarcoat anything.
That's what makes this a very valuable book for people who care about wine.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so much information in here. Best wine drinking in Beaune is to
right.
be had in only a few places where the lists are good, the food is excellent, and the wine vibe is humming all night. And Ma Cuisine is the place that you recommend. So that's just right in there. And you'd only find that, listeners, if you actually went through this from cover to cover. And I was surprised. Just one last observation here, and then I'm going to turn the page over to you and say, now you tell me what you think is the most important thing that's in here. Talking about the Southern Rhone, which has become a very, very popular region in the last 25 years here in the United States, and you say you've been a steady fan of two wines, two domains, Chateau Reyes and Chateau Beaucastel, and we had the pleasure of meeting Mark Perrin from Chateau Beaucastel once when he was in the United States, and we had a wonderful conversation with him. But here's what you say. Your loyalty to Chateauneuf-du-Pape has been in decline since 1998.
Yes.
The vintage was a hot one, which produced huge, jammy wines, highly praised by dominant critics. It launched Chateauneuf-du-Pape into an era of colossal-sized wines and hot vintages of 2000, 2003, and 2007, cemented that style. So today's Chateauneuf-du-Papes are not food-friendly. You've enjoyed some bottles, but now you're saying, I really don't like it anymore. The only ones I like are the challenging ones like 99, 2004, and 2006. I am going to ask you, since you don't mention 2002, why you missed that one out.
2002 were good, but they were a little dilute. They were definitely softer. There are some good 2002s, but there was a lot of in and flooding in the vineyards. And
right, that wasn't a really wet year.
Most of them were really good when they were young on release. And there are some good ones, but that was a very challenging vintage. That was one of the most challenging vintages. That is the only difficult vintage they've had since 98. I guess we can go back to since, I think before that it was like the most challenging vintage for them was maybe like 93 or 92. But the style has changed. The wines are much more explosive and much more jammy and tipping at 16% alcohol.
And you don't care for that.
I that's not my style. They do have tannin and stuffing which works for them, and the wines are popular and buy them for a bunch of restaurants. But it's just too much. For me, personally, I can't drink. Since the book is a reflection of my thoughts and a bunch of people we spoke to, many people told us their thoughts of Chateauneuf, the new vintages, the current vintages. So everything in the book is not just something I came up with. It's also we asked, we interviewed like 50 sommeliers.
Sure. And I understand. Now, what are a couple of things that you thought were particularly important that you put down in the book? I picked out the things that impressed me that I thought were really useful to me. What are a couple of your favorite things?
I think the food and wine pairing chapter is broken down by different cooking techniques or different aging of meat or different styles or different game bird. I think it's important to understand what wines work with food. That's an important topic for the wine professional. I think wine service, that's an important topic to really understand, and we give that from the sommelier's perspective. And then wine buying, which is mostly for sommeliers and for consumers, for, you know, what kind of wines to buy, you know, what to look for, you know, what kind of deals you're going to get, how you're going to get these deals. And, you know, there's lots of little things. You know, we were going to highlight every secret, but then he said, if you highlight every secret, it'll just be too pronounced. It'll just be, everyone's going to only go for it. So you have to read the whole book to kind of get the secrets rather than just, like, you know, bullet point of what the secrets are.
No, that's exactly what I did. I didn't intend to read the book from cover to cover, but I finished up doing that in one sitting, I should add. because I couldn't put it down. I couldn't figure. I thought, what's the next exciting and useful piece of information he's going to pass along?
Subtitled, How to Think and Drink Like the World's Top Wine Professionals. I think that explains a lot of the attitude behind the book.
But for me, I'm just a humble wine consumer.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found every piece of information there to be a nugget that I wanted to be able to remember. So the home wine drinker, the wine aficionado, budding sommelier, all of whom will get an enormous amount out of this book. And I think I think the industry owes you a debt of gratitude. Now, before we go, we should mention that you have a rather prominent position in one of the 18 restaurants whose wine list you control. Why don't you tell us a little bit about RN74?
Oh, sure. It was one of the days I was going to Burgundy. I was sitting at the Gare de Lyon train station in Paris, and I was looking up at the train station train board, and I was like, wow, yeah, we should have a restaurant that had a train board in it. And I always wanted a restaurant named after Burgundy. And in 2003, I wrote a business plan to open a restaurant called RN74 and take that idea of having a train board in the restaurant. And when I spoke to Michael and Mina about it in 2007, he's like, yeah, let's do it. And then I started planning it. And it's a restaurant I spend all my time in. It's a restaurant which I enjoy being there every day, and yeah, it's one of our 18 restaurants of the MENA Group, and that's home for me.
We will hope that next time we're in San Francisco, we'll have a chance to catch up with you there, and we can explore some more of your talent and some more of your thoughts in person. How would that?
That is fantastic. Anytime you want, I'm around. So just let me know.
Well, that's outstanding. Thank you so much for joining us today at On the Menu. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to many, many more great conversations about food and wine.
Anytime, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you both of you, and thank you everyone who's listening to this amazing show.
And now stay with us as we take a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I'm back again, heading into beer with someone who's pretty much been the standard bearer for establishing the success of craft beers in this country.
Well, not only that, Dogfish Head is quite iconic craft brewery, but Sam Caglione went beyond that and used his experience at Dogfish Head to write a book about how to start, survive, and grow as a small business. So this is a fascinating story at two levels. First of all, how he did it and how you can do it too. But secondly, there's a wonderful undercurrent of what's behind this wonderful set of brews called Dogfish Head.
Somebody up there loves Sam Caligoni.
Caligoni,
yeah, I think loves Peter Haig too. His name is Michael Jackson. We sometimes call him the other Michael Jackson in tribute to the fact that the dancer singer is probably slightly better known. But Michael Jackson and Peter have something in common. I think we've talked about it before on the air, but we'll do it again. Turns out we're almost exactly the same age, and we were born in the same town, and we never understood after we met why we had never met 60 years before. But I think it was that we went to different kinds of different high school on a different side of town. These schools were rivals, and pupils of one didn't talk to the other, and vice versa. But why are we talking Michael Jackson? We're talking Michael Jackson because he probably had a lot to do with inspiring Sam, whose last name I can never get right.
Caligoni.
That's all right.
And he wrote the foreword to the original publication of a book called Brewing Up a Business, the new edition of which arrived on our doorstep just a few months ago. So, Sam, I guess I'm going to hit you with this question, which I didn't announce ahead of time. Why publish it again?
Well, because a lot has changed since it first came out, both for me and for my company, Dogfish Head, but most importantly, considering the content of the book, is what's changed for small businesses. And I think while the Internet's been around for decades, small businesses in the last 5 years have really learned how to harness the power of social media and sort of the grassroots approach of building an online fan base and communication mechanism when you think of the Twitters and the Facebooks of the world and how we use our own website, dogfish.com. So there's a lot more in this new edition focus on using this book to help you grow your entrepreneurial business using these sort of grassroots mechanisms.
And we might quickly stress, incidentally, that if you're not doing that, there's a good chance your small business is already out of business, and if not, it's probably headed in that direction.
The cost of reaching customers through social media compared to sort of the old world media of television or billboards or even print ads. I think all entrepreneurs, if they're thinking smarter, are keeping that in mind.
Now, this is really two books in one, isn't it? It's a book for beer lovers and dogfish head lovers in particular, and then it has another purpose as well.
It tells the story about the evolution of our own little brewery. So if you love this Dogfish Head beer, if you love beer in general, you'll appreciate learning more about the brewing industry and particularly the craft brewing industry. But the primary audience is really business people and entrepreneurs and people looking to turn their passions into their livelihoods. So that's really the primary focus of the book.
I found an interesting quote deep into the book that I thought was an awfully good place to start, and I'll ask you to comment after I note it.
Sure.
A big brewery opened in the city north of you in Delaware. Mm-hmm. And there was an interview with the founder you report on, a founder with an impressive business pedigree compared to my own. So I was hopeful I would learn a thing or two by reading it. But anyway, the man was interviewed, and the interview asked him a final question. Which of the beers that you make is your favorite? The businessman responded that he actually didn't like beer and preferred to drink juicy juice. I remember reading it twice to make sure I was reading it correctly. I was still quite naive about business and wasn't 100% sure that Dogfish Head was a brewery that would be around for a long time, but I was sure of one thing: this guy was screwed.
Yep, that's true.
And his brewery was not around for a very long time because he made a serious mistake, a mistake that Sam never made and that you'll see through and through in this book and that you better have if you're in your small business, and that is that you absolutely love what did you do. The owner of the other business we reported on obviously loved money more than he loved beer, as you know. He had no passion for his job. He was just making a widget with the hope that it would lead to an IPO. I've heard from other brewers that this brewery owner spent his day sitting in a fancy office suite high above the production floor reading the Wall Street Journal. And this is not how you're going to be successful. In fact, this is probably exactly the opposite, right?
That's basically the lesson of there's no point in getting into a business unless you're A, ready to work your butt off, and unless you absolutely love the product that you make. And if you're making a product that you don't even like enjoying, like in the case of this guy who owned a brewery but didn't drink beer, odds are you're not going to be successful, because entrepreneurial businesses inherently go through very difficult, cash-strapped startup phases and very awkward adolescent years when you're trying to grow your business and you don't have a lot of money. So if you're trying to get into an entrepreneurial business because of your love of money, it's not going to work. You have to love the product and love your work. And if you're good at those two things and you're successful, the money will come later.
Don't be the dumb person why it's called Dogfish Head.
No, that's a great question. I always forget how goofy the name of our brewery sounds. But while it sounds crazy to most people, Dogfish Head, so most people here have heard of Hilton Head in the Carolinas. Dogfish Head is a jut of land off of Booth Bay Harbor, Maine. So all my breweries in Delaware, that's where I met my wife, and she's from Delaware, and that's why we started here. I wanted to keep a little New England in her name, so that's why we're called Dogfish Head. It's a jut of land up in Maine.
But it's nowhere near Delaware. I assumed it was in Delaware.
Yep, no, it's up in Maine where I'm originally from.
Oh, I see. So that's where you started out.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about Delaware with an interesting sort of a love-hate relationship, because you decided for reasons which are perhaps not worth explaining that you would start your brewery in Delaware, but you forgot one thing.
What's that?
Well, don't you remember? You forgot that breweries were illegal in Delaware.
Oh, I thought it was a rhetorical question, yeah. We were very naive. I was only 24 or 25 years old when I was starting the brewery, so I went under construction here in Delaware, assuming that the laws were already existing, but I found out very quickly that every state's brewing laws had to be updated after Prohibition, and since no breweries in Delaware had opened since Prohibition, discussion until Dogfish Head, I quickly realized I first had to write state-level legislation to make it illegal to open a brewery. So that was a very, very quick lesson in local politics, and it's a testament to what a great business friendly state Delaware is, that I was able to write our own legislation and within weeks be arguing at the floor of the state senate and getting it passed.
Yeah, that was a really cool picture of you actually standing next to the governor explaining the legislation that you were about to get passed.
Yeah, and you can see in that picture I'm sweating profusely from my underarms because I'm so nervous to be talking to the governor of Delaware about beer.
So I have another question. I just wanted to follow on. This really is a follow-on of the 21st Amendment. Maybe you should have a beer called 21st Amendment Ale just to go back to that memory, too.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. There's actually a brewery owned by my friends in San Francisco called 21st Amendment Brewery, so somebody was thinking the same thing that you were there.
Well, there's a 21st Amendment bar and restaurant in Washington, Pennsylvania, not far from where we live.
Oh, really?
That's the only reason I know it's the 21st Amendment. I can't remember. I have no idea what the other 20 are.
All right.
Well, of course, you said a lot has changed, but one of the things that's changed is, if you were going to do startup, toddler, teen, adult, I mean, like, where would you put your brewery at this stage? I mean, you've been around for some years now, and it's also, you're in an environment with extraordinary new competition, really small startups. I mean, how do you fit into this craft beer picture now?
Yeah, I mean, we're technically considered a regional brewery, and our scale is such that we're still, we started as the smallest commercial brewery in America in 1995 here in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. And in that era, we were making maybe 15 gallons of beer a day. Flash forward to today, and we're the largest craft brewery in the Mid-Atlantic region, and we make about 7,000 cases of beer every day here. But to give you a context of just how big the brewing industry is, Dogfish Head Brewery, even at 7,000 cases a day, is about 1/18 of 1% market share in America. So we're still a very tiny brewery up against very huge public conglomerates, but we're certainly not a tiny brewery anymore. And so in Brewing Up a Business, I talk about that journey of going from extremely small, minute, to just small. So that's where we've graduated to small from tiny.
So that's quite a step. And you've done most of that with word of mouth and social media?
Yeah, I mean, we really only advertise in beer publications. I don't advertise in any mainstream publications, and most of our marketing resources goes towards our online world and to the events that we hold.
And you come up with the most amazing new product all the time.
Well, thanks. It's a fun part of our job.
How do you dream them up? Well, there are so many of them in the book. Do you have a particular favorite? I mean, I like the one, the barley wine one myself, which you decided to make in 40-ounce hand-filled bottles.
Oh, the malt liquor.
And put brown paper bags inside the container.
Brown paper bags for every single bottle, yeah.
Because everybody drinks a large beer out of a brown paper sack.
Yeah, for those malt liquors. But what's nice about what we do is we have a small brewery in our restaurant, and so we still have a lot of fun doing the test batches in our small brewery in our restaurant, and then we let the customers in the restaurant try all the different R&D research beers, and then they give us their feedback. And if people fall in love with the beer and we fall in love with it as coworkers, then we decide to roll that out to large-scale national distribution.
Okay, and what are some of your top sellers, Sam?
Top sellers include beers like Raison d'Etre, made with raisins and beet sugars, 60-Minute IPA, which is a nice hoppy India Pale Ale, Midas Touch, made with saffron and honey, and our Indian Brown Ale, which is a real roasty, hoppy beer.
Now, you make a stout, too, that has, I think, somehow one of the ingredients is espresso coffee?
We do a beer called Chicory Stout that has organic roasted Mexican coffee in it and chicory as well.
Where do you come up with these formulas?
Well, it's usually a combination of either doing research, and I read a lot in history, brewing history, culinary history, and or just following our own whim, you know, thinking of beers that haven't been done before and taking a risk and trying to make them ourselves.
Let's turn to the other side of the coin, if you will, and that's Brewing Up a Business. as a primer for growing a small business. We can't give too much away because we must make sure that people buy a copy, especially now it's in paperback and it's less expensive. But if I could ask you to identify perhaps the three most important lessons learned along the way that helped you to be successful, is that fair?
Yeah, sure, I can take a crack at that. I'd say the biggest one, and it's often it gets said very often, is most small businesses go out of business because they're undercapitalized. So doing a business plan up front and making sure you really know what costs you need to open your business, and not just get it open, but assume that you're not going to make money for 6 months to a year, and so that you're going to need extra cash flow or just some reserves to leave in the bank when you open until you're profitable. So having enough money to open, I'd say, is a key. Equally important is a really well-differentiated product. In other words, as a tiny company, you can't come into a marketplace with some commodity that's very generic and assume that you can compete against the giant international companies that make, you know, whatever widgets they make as efficiently as possible. So a very well-differentiated, unique product, having the cash on hand to actually sustain and get your business growing. And then the third thing I would say is surrounding yourself with really talented people whose talents complement your own as quickly as possible. And I tell the story in our book how, you know, I'm more of a sales and marketing, a product development kind of guy. That's what I love. I'm not as strong as the cost of goods, accounting, operations side of our business. So as soon as we hit some level of financial stability, I found people that were really strong in those areas that complemented my own to invite them into our company to help grow it. And that's a big reason we've been successful thus far.
Now, you talk about cash flow as being king. Not are you profitable, but do you have enough cash to run?
Right.
And you explain how you used to call people individually and say the check is in the mail, and sometimes it was, sometimes it wasn't.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel bad a little bit, but in the olden days I used to make a few white lies about if we owed somebody money and they called and said, well, we're not going to ship you your new pallet of hops unless you pay us. And I could say, oh, well, the check's already been sent. You should get it next week. Please send us our hops this week. So thankfully, most people gave us good terms and we were able to make it through that period.
Now, you are a marketing guy. What factor determined that on the cover of your book, Brewing Up a Business, was a picture of you? Why is this the selling point?
Oh, why'd they put a picture of me on the cover of the book?
Right, because you're a marketing person. I thought maybe there was a reason for this.
I think, you know, partly because, I'm out doing a lot of events for our brewery. I recently did a television series called Brewmasters on the Discovery Network. So a lot of people in the beer industry do recognize me by face. So,
so
I think the publisher thought it'd be a good way to remind people of Dogfish Head.
Besides, he's running for president as a spokesperson for the beer party. Somebody already tried the tea party in Delaware and it didn't go down too well.
Yeah, that didn't work so well.
So perhaps Beer King will be more successful. Have you thought about that? I mean, it seems like you've done the business, you've written the book, you're now a self-help expert, you know how to write laws for the state of Delaware. Ever thought about going into politics?
No, I guess I've gotten a little jaded in my middle age here, but, I've kind of realized that pretty much the only adult job I've ever had is running Dogfish Head Brewery, so I think I'm pretty much unhireable at this point, but for any other job in the country except this one, so I'm gonna stick with what I'm pretty good at.
So you can't imagine at this moment doing anything else, just keeping on doing more of the same?
Yeah, I mean, this is what gives me the biggest thrill in my life, this whole opportunity to think about what are we going to do next and help the people I work with make this even a more special place. That's what I take the most joy in professionally.
And, you have your finger on the pulse of the whole craft brew industry. Would you single out just a couple of trends that you can see?
Sure. The fact that craft brewings, the small breweries in America, there's now over 1,600 small breweries in America, which means the average American lives within 10 miles of a local brewery. And these small breweries, that's the only place that the beer industry is growing right now. In other words, overall beer sales in America are flat, and that's only because the giant international companies that make that sort of generic light lager, no, there's not a lot of excitement around them. But the small breweries, the independent craft breweries in everybody's neighborhood are for the most part, really growing, and that shows that American beer lovers are really embracing this idea of locally made fresh beer. And I think so it's part of that greater sort of localvore trend, whether it's farmers markets or artisanal bakeries or micro roasteries for coffee. Craft beer fits into that greater realm of sort of high-end artisanal products, and yet it's a great affordable, it's sort of an affordable connoisseurship, because world-class beer doesn't cost hundreds of dollars the way world-class wine does. It costs $10 or $12 a six-pack, so it's very accessible, and that's the trend, is people are seeking out more flavorful beer and pairing it with food because they see it as part of that localvore trend that's very approachable and, you know, financially viable.
Well, I think you've written a wonderful allegory of life. It would be useful to any small business person. In any event, even if they don't find it useful, they'll enjoy riding along with Sam as he's gone through life so far. I can't help but believe that there's going to be a sequel for the original that we just read and the sequel that's coming. We know what the perfect accompaniment is when you're sitting in the evening studying this book.
Yeah, in fact, I was thinking of only writing on every other page, and the pages that were blank people could use as their coaster while they drink and read the beer, or read the book and drink the beer together.
Sam, let's say resounding cheers to our friend St. Michael Jackson up in the sky.
Amen to that. Cheers to Michael.
And hope that he's looking down and watching over all of us, and especially Dogfish Head, as it continues to prosper, because you certainly earned it, and we thank you for sharing the formula.
Well, thank you, Peter, and thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks. Good to talk to you again, Sam.
Okay, thank you. Talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
And now, don't go away. We're just going to take a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Thanks for staying with us, because you're going to enjoy meeting with the saucy mama coming up, Susie Barhite. Well, let's just listen to her talk and explain her line. I can't help but mention that one of the great perks of doing On the Menu is making friends, meeting these wonderful people, and then periodically reuniting, and that's what we're doing this morning with Susie Barhite, who is also known as Saucy Mama. Welcome back to On the Menu, Susie.
It's wonderful to be back.
Now, the last time we talked to you was in 2008, and you were always moving forward, so I'm sure you've done a lot since then. But for those who maybe didn't hear the initial explanation, just a brief explanation of how you got into this business and what you do.
My husband and I had a deli, and it was at a time when you couldn't bring large quantities of really good mustard, or that wasn't available to us in our small town in Oregon. So we had a tradition of making mustard in the family. We started making our own to supplement our sandwiches, and then the business accidentally grew out of that. People wanted to take it home and loved it, and here we are today.
Right. We got several new mustards just a few weeks ago, so you keep on adding different varieties too.
I do.
How many labels do you have?
We have, oh my gosh, I lose track. We have our House Barhite mustards, we have our Willamette Valley mustards, the Saucy Mama, which is a new label to you. We've done that since, I think, 2009, but I could be wrong, and there's a chef out of Cincinnati called Paul Sturkey, and I've worked with him, so we have the Sturkey dressings and Aviator Ale mustards, and which are made with really good ales, and they're really good mustards, and then we have Tailgate wing sauces.
Wow.
Yeah, well, we tried a marinade that you sent with the latest batch. I can't remember what that was called now.
It could have been Sweet Heat is one of my new favorites.
That was it, Sweet Heat. That was exactly it.
It is, and it's terrific marinade. It's not too sweet. It's not cloying, and it has just a little heat. So if you have a large group, everybody just loves it, and when I use it, food just disappears.
Now, what's your product development process like? That's a complicated set of words to describe what you do when you're brewing up some new magic sauce. What's it like in the Bar Height Development Kitchen?
I read a lot, magazines, cookbooks, eat out a lot, and then just kind of mull over ideas, and all of a sudden something bubbles to the surface, and I think, well, let's try that, and I work with it, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But it, even out of mistakes, you learn, and something happens. It just seems to happen.
Now, you have a family to help you. Do you pick on them and say, you guys have to try this?
Yes, I do. I've got a very honest family.
So there's a Mr. Barheit and lots of little Barheits.
Yes, there's little Barheits. So, and everybody pulled in the taste. My kids, their kids, my husband Jan, and we just, they eat a lot.
They eat a lot. Well, the kids are supposed to do that, right?
Yes, they are. It's not been a problem.
Yeah. Well, we have to test the latest mustards on our granddaughter loves mustard. She's only four.
Good for her. I've trained my grandchildren too, Ed, but good for her.
She makes mustard sandwiches. I have to say that, unfortunately, her favorite mustard right now seems to be
French's yellow.
I know, but you'll start somewhere. Yeah.
Well, they're going to be visiting in August, so I'll get her into some Saucy Mama stuff.
Okay. And she will graduate from the yellow.
I'm sure she will. of course, the latest thing we got, somebody sent us, is truffle mayo.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
We have a
gal that imports truffles, and we put them into using her Daniel's vinegar and truffles and make mustard with it. That is just absolutely fabulous.
Oh, you have that too in your line.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect
we might have some of that, but I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I'll double check it.
If you don't, I will send you some.
Well, I'll check the cupboard, and if there isn't any, I'll be sure to let you know that we need
some. It's because it's fabulous.
Now, you're nothing if not a connoisseur of wine as well as food, from what I understand from the conversation we've had earlier on. So you're from a lot of people would consider an extraordinarily out-of-the-way place called Walla Walla, Washington.
Well, I'm from Pendleton, which is a cowboy town, but it's 50 miles away from Walla Walla, which is a wine town.
And you're in California now, carrying wines from?
From Walla Walla. That wine will travel.
So, I mean, two names I know making wines from that area are Gary Figgins from Leonetti Cellars and Charles Smith, whose label I'm not sure of these days. It's probably just Charles Smith Wines. But there are undoubtedly some other names. Could you share just a couple that people might be able to find if they want to explore this region?
Well, Long Shadows Vineyard is just, they're doing fabulous wines.
Yeah,
their Feather and their Pedestal are a Merlot and a Cabernet, and they're wonderful.
We're going to look into those.
And they even have a red table wine called Nine Hats, where the nine winemakers work together and make this wine, and it's just fabulous drinking everyday wine.
Now, have you thought about getting together with them and perhaps making a range of vinegar products? I mean, that would be a sort of a natural combination.
Have not thought about it, but it's an idea. We certainly have the resources there.
Well, you know, I was listening.
No, hold on a second. I want to make sure that I claim my 2%.
Okay.
Finders fee.
When you do that.
When I'm ready, I will.
Well, you know, the guy who won the burger contest at South Beach Food and Wine claims that it's a special mustard that he used that a friend of his makes that put him over the winning edge. But I can't remember the name of the mustard.
It was probably Barheit.
Well, there are some other good mustards. We think ours are wonderful, but there are really some really good mustards out there.
Aren't you just amazed when you started this? I mean, how many mustards were there around? Aren't you just amazed at how this whole market has grown?
Yes. When we started, there was hardly any and all, but it's exploded since then.
Uh-huh.
Yes, which is fabulous because I'm a firm believer the more people you have there doing good things with food, just the more people eat good food.
Now, will you be heading further down the marinade and barbecue sauce kind of direction, do you think?
Yes, I will, because I enjoy that. and summer, spring cooking with fresh vegetables and that kind of thing. It's just, they're fun to work with.
Right. Well, I could see that coming, I'm sure. So that's probably next stop, right, Susie?
It is.
All right. Well, anyhow, how about giving us a website?
It's Barhyte, B-A-R-H-Y-T-E .com.
Okay, and you can order directly from there?
Yes, you can.
And do stores stock it as well, your sauces and mustards? And
we are in select specialty shop, and mostly it's scattered around.
Okay. So, but the best
and high-end groceries.
Okay, but the best shot at it is to actually just order it online, huh?
Yes, always available and easy to find.
Okay. Now, do you have a store locator, though, just in case people say, oh, I got to find some of this right now?
Well, we do not have a store locator, okay. And the reason we don't is because the products people carry change, and they carry one of our products on the locator, they may not carry the product here.
Right. People are better to shop online.
Yes. So you can get them through Amazon.com.
Oh, well, there you go. That's a nice, convenient way to do it, too. Now, we hope you have a wonderful trip to the Golden State or the bankrupt Golden State or whatever you call California these days.
It is. But it's beautiful, beautiful weather. And, well, we're in Palm Springs, actually, which for my travel people that want just a quaint village, Palm Springs is it.
Yeah.
For the mid-century modern little tiny country inns. It's a beautiful spot, and not exactly what a lot of people expect
right. When
they think of the desert. It's just, it's very, very quaint, very beautiful, and great restaurants.
Yeah, well, a friend of ours has a B&B there, but I can't even remember the name of it.
Well, there are so many, and they're tiny and wonderful.
So, and he says the time to go is when the desert's in bloom in the spring.
Yes, yes.
Well, I'd love to see spring. Anyhow, Susie, keep us posted, and it's good talking to you again.
Well, nice talking to you, and I look forward to talking to you again. And if you don't have any of the products we've talked about, I'll get them to you.
Okay, Susie, thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Short break, and we'll see you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
There are so many wonderful cheeses in the world, and now even in the U.S. of A., we could bring you a different cheese, a different style, a different brand every single program and still not exhaust it. Next stop, you'll understand the name of the brand. If you taste the cheese, it's called Crave.
Yeah, but that's not why it's called that. I mean, it's a wonderful double entendre, and double entendre is particularly appropriate since the family's last name is French and undoubtedly was pronounced Crave.
Uh-huh.
You didn't realize it.
I forgot,
it's not like we all scream for ice cream. It's called We All Crave Cheese.
Well, I guess it's not unusual if you're in Wisconsin that the idea should pop into your head to make cheese, especially if you're a dairy farmer. Let's welcome Debbie Crave of Crave Brothers Farmstead Cheese. Hello, Debbie. Yeah, you were going to give us a little short history of this is truly a family farm and family business, right?
Exactly. We have a family dairy farm and a family cheese factory right across from the farm, and both businesses are owned by four brothers. And I happen to be married to one of the brothers, and we also have the next generation involved in both the farm and the cheese factory, and so they're truly family businesses, and that's been a goal of the brothers all along, is to build a successful family business that they could see prosper and their children involved in the land and producing a quality cheese long into the future.
Now, we hear that's challenging. Being a small farmer is a challenging thing to be profitable and be able to stay on the land. What's been your secret?
I think what has made us successful is four brothers working together, bringing different expertise to the business and concentrating on that. One brother originally took care of the cows. Another brother was involved in the bookkeeping and feeding. Another brother was involved in the land aspects, raising the feed, planning the the crops. And so they specialized, and each brother had their area that they focused on and made successful and made it so we could produce high-quality milk and be profitable, because we do tell people that are interested in cheese making, you need your farm to be successful first so that you can then concentrate on the cheese-making aspect. And it, they're two separate businesses. My husband, George, used to be a full-time dairy farmer, and now he's a full-time cheesemaker.
He's the cheesemaker, isn't he?
Yes. And he doesn't take off his hairnet and run over to the farm to jump on the tractor. He misses his interaction with the cows, but he's a full-time cheesemaker. We get, on the weekends, we do a lot with the farm, and our children show cows at the county fair. So he gets his taste of the farming aspect on the weekends.
But now this is a 25-year history of cheesemaking once you put the pipeline in, I guess, the pipeline crossing the road. You're still pretty specialized. You only make a relatively small number of cheese products. Perhaps you want like to go over what those are.
Sure. One of our main cheeses is fresh mozzarella, and it's especially popular in the summer and fall when tomatoes are in season. And, yeah, we do make that cheese year-round. It's becoming a lot more common in sandwiches and in pizzas. We also make mascarpone, a sweet cream mascarpone.
Oh, that's fabulous, by the way. I wish I...
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I really would like to have made it into desserts, but I don't bake or I don't know anything about making desserts, but it was just a beautiful, beautiful mascarpone.
Well, we're eating a teaspoonful at a time. We don't have it in the studio because it makes too much mess.
It should be made into tiramisu, right?
It should be.
That's the most common use for mascarpone, but we like to be a little different. So we've created a very easy chocolate mascarpone pie that's fun to share with visitors that we have. And in the winter, we love to prepare a mascarpone mushroom soup with mascarpone. So it's so fun and easy to work with, and we get a lot of accolades on it, and we just recently found out this week it got second place at the U.S. Cheese Championship, so we're really pleased.
Congratulations, that's
great. To get that recognition. Then we also make a string cheese that we call Farmer's Broth, and then we make a French-style cheese called Le Frère and Petit Frère that sort of reflect our story and our farmstead, and we make that in smaller batches. It's a really high-end, what we'd like to say, cheese course kind of cheese. Four different cheeses that are unique to us.
Now, the Frère, it's unusual in that it's a soft cheese, right? It's a soft, and especially soft in the center cheese.
Yes.
It's a washed rind
cheese.
Semi-soft,
washed rind. You could also say it's sort of in the brie category, but it's not a brie. It has a different coloring on the outside, kind of a toasty color, and a brie might be with a white mold. We wash special cultures on the outside of the cheese to give it flavor and color, and that particular cheese just got a third place this week at the U.S. Cheese Championship.
Oh, that's great. No, congratulations.
It's a very fine cheese. I mean, there's a wonderful subtlety about the flavor in the center, which a brie doesn't have. Mm-hmm. It's reminiscent of other French soft cheeses, the names of which candidly escape, but if I were going to describe it, I would describe it as, to someone who likes cheese, if you found a fine-flavored, soft-rind, soft-in-the-center French cheese that you like, it's a lot like that. And that's presumably is why you use the French for brothers.
Exactly. And it is similar to a Reblochon.
That's the one I was going to guess. I was just muttering that, whispering it into the mic. Except I wasn't sure I could pronounce it.
I was hoping you'd pick up what I was saying.
Well, there you go. Well, Reblochon. Reblochon is one of my favorite French cheeses.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And you'll just love this one, listeners, I have to tell you.
Yeah, now your heritage is Irish-French, so the French was a natural to you.
Yes, and that was partly why the brothers wanted to create this cheese, to just talk about their heritage, their farm, their family, through the cheese. And the smaller version of Le Frère, called Petit Frère, comes in a cute, creative wooden box that actually has an illustration of the youngest crepe brother with his fair calf. So we're always trying to tell the story of the farm, the family, the whole farming aspect of our business.
I'll bet the name was once pronounced Crave, huh?
It surely could have been, yes.
Now, you use Holstein cows.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't know why, but I guess because of background on dairy farm. I mean, I think of Jerseys almost automatically, but you use Holstein, which is also good milk.
Right, and they're the most common breed and very common in Wisconsin.
Now, did you come from a rural background, Debbie?
I was raised in the country, not on a farm. I met my husband, George, in 4-H when we were still in high school.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I didn't exactly know him from farming, but from the 4-H circles that we were involved with and county fair activities.
So you're familiar with the lifestyle.
Yes.
That's great.
It must feel like living out a dream, huh?
It is. It's wonderful. I can sit here and look out to the farm and maybe see a tractor go by or my daughter ride her bike from home over to the farm to work with her calves. And in a half an hour, I can still be in Madison if I needed to meet with someone at a grocery store or take a flight.
Don't go to Madison just now. There's a lot of trouble brewing there.
Yeah, avoid the downtown. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, there's somebody with a pizza shop providing all the protesters with pizza slices.
Ah, wonderful.
So it's a real boost for the pizza industry.
That's
Madison.
It's nice to see some kind of solidarity, ha ha. The whole thing really seems kind of silly to us, looking at it from a distance.
Yes.
And probably looks pretty silly to you, looking at it from a closer distance, too.
Well, we just go to work and every day and do our job and tell our children to respect what they have in life and to be thankful for that. And certainly you get what you accomplish, what you work for, and you can't expect a lot, certainly, from the government. We've never been big people to look to the government to bail us out for anything.
Right, and do work hard. I mean, I remember my great-uncle. I'm just saying he had a dairy farm in Ohio, and I don't think he ever had a day off in his whole life.
He probably didn't want a day off. His cow,
Uncle Frank.
He liked his cows a lot more than he liked other people.
Yeah, I think he did say that once, actually.
Yes. And we have a few more employees now, so on Christmas we don't have to rush back to the farm if we don't need to. But I remember the days when we'd get in the car and go visit my family or my husband's family, and we'd have to leave at 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon to get back to milk at 5:30.
Sure.
And it certainly brings good memories and builds character, and there's certainly nothing wrong with it.
Now, is there anything new in the future, aside from the fact that you're going to pass this wonderful tradition on to another generation already, because you have people studying up to do that? Are you going to branch out and produce some other different kinds of cheeses, do you think?
I do think we will. We're not there yet. We're certainly happy with the cheeses we're producing now and have enough on our plate, but there's always someone asking for a different version, a different type of cheese, double cream, or another flavor of mascarpone. So we could certainly do that. And there's also other aspects of the business that we could develop, and I like to say that's the next generation of Craves, whether we have a store on the farm. We do not right now because we live on a little dead-end road, but maybe someday we would have a store, or maybe we would do some agriculture tourism. We do a little bit now, but not a lot. We're trying not to be a destination. That's another whole business.
Yes,
right,
it is.
Right. Now, what about getting some cheese? Can people buy it online if they're not in the immediate area where you distribute?
We try to point people on our website to places they can go get our cheese, and there are a couple of stores that will mail order. And we hope to, down the road, have a few of our cheeses for sale online. We don't yet, but you can go to almost any part of the country and usually find a store, hopefully in your neighborhood, higher-end specialty cheese store that would have our cheeses, or they could be mail-ordered from one place that's in Wisconsin.
Well, give us the website, because the website is full of all kinds of interesting stories and recipes and a lot of color. So the website is?
Yes, okay. It's www.cravecheese.com.
Well, that's a good tagline, too, Crave Cheese.
We have the right last name for the food industry,
exactly.
Wouldn't you say?
I should say so.
I'm going to satisfy my craving. And
you're
going
to go steal the rest of the
I'm just going to go cut a small piece. just because Debbie's made me hungry for some by talking as she has done with us this afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us, Debbie, and keep up the great work. It's wonderful to hear a success on the land. And a story of a business that's going to span generations. Now, what a pleasure it is.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks, Debbie.
My pleasure, Ralph. Thank you, Ann.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Well, we're so glad that you decided to spend this part of the day with us. And
I wonder if we've ever made it clear. I mean, we do a program every week, but anybody who wants to listen can just go on and listen to all the archive programs,
of course they can.
Anytime.
Anytime at all. But I'm sure some of you just can hardly wait for the new program to come out every Sunday. So we're glad you do, and we're delighted to bring it to you, and we'll do the same again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.